time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 24th, 2021. Today I have a guest whose passionate interest in bicycles, from racing them in his youth to riding pretty much everywhere he goes, to the work he has done and is doing with NUMO, an organization that connects diverse allies and actors around urban mobility issues in communities throughout the globe, and to his current gig back home in Bogota, Colombia, leaves you breathless with his breadth and depth of knowledge. And when I think about what a podcast is, I sometimes forget that besides the entertainment factor, there is the important task of conveying compelling information. Carlos Pardo offers us that kind of conversation today. First up, however, is a story that went viral on TikTok this week when some teenagers in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, were stopped by the police, had their bikes temporarily confiscated, and one of the teens was actually arrested. As things go these days, this incident was caught on two videos, and Billy Binion, the assistant editor of Reason.com, a print and online magazine, covered the story. I rang him up to get a deeper understanding of what happened. Hi, Billy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. I found a story you did for your, I guess it's a paper, it's an online organization. Tell me, Reason.com, you're the assistant editor. What is Reason.com?
Sure. So Reason is a magazine, actually. We do once monthly in print and then daily online, politics and culture, so everything across the gamut. I write about criminal justice and immigration, but we have people that write about, you know, cultural issues, general politics, trade, I mean, everything.
Okay. Well, the reason I found you was a story you posted. So it's today. This will be heard 2 days from now or 3 days from now, Saturday. But this is the 20th. And it's about police. I don't know what to call it exactly. You know, they were harassing some teenagers in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. Now, you're on the West Coast. So how did you pick up on this story?
Sure. So there were a couple of videos circulating Tuesday morning that showed an interaction between police and a group of, you know, I wouldn't say like four or five teens who were on their bicycles. And there was a longer clip and a shorter clip. And the shorter clip basically showed these kids having their bikes confiscated. And then when you watch the longer clip, you saw that they were basically cited for some traffic violations, you know, riding their bike not on the sidewalk and riding on the wrong side of the street, as teenagers sometimes tend to do. But then the most interesting part is that they're then lectured over not having their bikes registered with the state, which most people probably don't even know is a thing. In New Jersey, it's not required to have your bike registered at large, but in this particular town, Perth Amboy, as you said, you do. You have to license your bicycle with the state. And they say it's because they can then use that information to help you if it's stolen, so it's quote unquote for your own good. But obviously, as we see in these instances, you know, police can then use that to kind of weaponize it against you and kind of wield power over you. One of those teens was arrested, and then all of the teens had their bikes seized. You know, they were eventually given the bikes back, but not until afterwards, when an officer berated them and threatened to keep it because they didn't have their license sticker attached to the bikes.
So there's an interesting sort of perspective on this. We had six officers. I don't know how many teens there were, maybe four or five. And the truth is that all the officers were white and all of the kids were black. Mm-hmm. So given the way things seem to be going these days and the way things are these days, do you see as sort of racist kind of attitude? Do you think the same? Well, of course, we can't speculate whether they would have done the same thing to white kids, right?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. So I write a lot about the effects of over-criminalization. Basically, there are a lot of laws, really stupid laws, that increase the likelihood that the public will have to interact with law enforcement. And so I think it is absolutely fair to say that the criminal justice system has a systemic racial issue. For instance, I know Black people are 4 times more likely to be arrested on drug charges despite using drugs at the same rate as whites. And so I don't think it's necessarily a problem of, you know, white officer hates Black person. I'm sure there are instances of that, and it's deplorable. But I think the broader issue, the root issue, is that we have systemic problems in the criminal justice system where we have embedded police officers into certain communities to go after victimless crimes. If crimes are victimless, we don't need law enforcement to be exercising that sort of jurisdiction. I mean, one of the things I always say is that if there is a crime on the books, then law enforcement needs to be willing to exercise deadly force to stop it, right? Because we've seen time and time again that happens. You know, these routine traffic stops can turn deadly. We saw that with Dante Wright just last week. I wrote a piece about that called Overcriminalization Killed Dante Wright. The reason being that he was pulled over for expired tags and having his air freshener in the wrong spot. We have to tackle the root of the problem, which is that a lot of times police simply don't need to be having these interactions with the public in the first place.
Right. So this video, which we will post, I've already posted a link to your story on our Facebook page, and this video is available for people to see. Are you going to continue to follow up on this? Is there any way to find out whether Perth Amboy, I mean, they must know how many people are watching this video and just kind of shaking their heads and wagging their fingers at them. This is ridiculous.
Right. So I followed up for comment this morning, and they said they were too slammed to return my call, which I'm sure they are kind of inundated with media requests right now. I do think that the best way to change bad laws is to shine a spotlight on them. That's kind of what I like to do in my work. I mean, who would have known that it was illegal in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, to not have your bicycle registered with the state until today? We should tell these stories because they do have real world impacts, as we keep seeing.
Well, it is also interesting, if I am not mistaken, that the boys were saying, we're not from here.
Yes, yeah, I include that in my story, which, I mean, that's kind of one of the most interesting parts, right? Is, you know, as the teen who was arrested is carted away in the police cruiser, he keeps saying, I'm from Edison, just down the road. But even so, you know, when they go back to get their bikes, I reference that interview that one filmed for his TikTok with the cop. And she basically says, if you don't have a receipt for your bike, and if it's not registered with Perth Amboy, I can keep it. And it's too bad. I don't know if your viewers are familiar with civil forfeiture, which is a practice where the government can steal your assets if you're merely suspected of a crime. I just reported on a case yesterday where a man had his brand new truck seized at the border because he stopped to take some pictures and pissed off some Border Patrol officers. And they seized his car under probable cause. I mean, these things can ruin people's lives. And we should really talk about why we're having so many interactions with police in the first place. I think people would have much more trust in law enforcement if they spent their time focusing on actual crime. I think people in Perth Amboy would be better served if the police zeroed in on murders and rapes and not people riding their bikes.
Yes, especially they say you should be on the sidewalk, which, by the way, there is no question in my mind that if you read the bicycle laws or the vehicle laws in New Jersey, you do not ride on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I mean, I used to live in Washington, D.C. I now live in L.A., but D.C. is a very pedestrian-heavy city. I used to bike, and I did bike on the sidewalk once and got yelled at by quite a few pedestrians, so I never did that again. I mean, anyone who's ridden a bike, I would encourage them to try to ride on the sidewalk when there are people walking around. You're considered a vehicle. You're supposed to be in the street.
That is exactly right. Well, Billy, I really appreciate you writing this story and bringing it to our attention. This is a show about bicycling and on every level, from advocacy to what goes on with police and how they treat bicyclists, which is not always very good. Very well, I should say, very well. So we're speaking with Billy Binion. He is the assistant editor of Reason.com. If you'd like to read his story, it's from the April 20th online edition, reason.com. Thanks for talking with me today, and keep up the interesting work. I will be following you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
All right. You have a great afternoon.
Thanks, you too.
Okay. Billy Binion is the assistant editor for Reason.com. If you want to watch the videos and read Billy's account of the incident, you can log on to our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, for the April 24th episode. Or mosey on over to our Facebook page and scroll down. You can also go to Reason.com for April 20th. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with Carlos Pardo about the joyousness of bicycling. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Carlos Pardo is many things, including a psychologist and urbanist. He writes and talks about going slow, tech-enabled disruptions, and is passionate about the place of the bicycles in transportation. His work has taken him all over the globe, but now, grounded by the pandemic, Carlos is back in his native Bogota, still working on all kinds of cycling-related projects. Our conversation today traces the expansion of bicycle infrastructure and bicycling itself in Bogota, Colombia, as well as offers some insight into the kinds of ideas that Carlos, in his role with Numo especially, is putting into practice to expand the use of bicycles, especially e-bikes. He also gives us some down-to-earth talk on how we might fashion our infrastructure and climate solution plans here in the U.S. with some simple and easy-to-implement ideas. Let's hope someone's listening. Hello, Carlos. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. I'm very pleased to be able to speak with you. How are you?
Good, and thanks for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So our mutual friend, Dr. Tab Combs, sort of turned me on to you and your work, and it is extensive. I'd like you to give our listeners a little bit of a background about you, where you grew up, and how you got into the work you're doing.
Okay, so I'm from Bogota, in Colombia. I'm actually a psychologist, and was a bicycle racer for a while when I was in my teen years, which got me into cycling a lot, but of course in terms of sports. But then later when I was studying psychology, I was able to do an internship on organizational psychology in an NGO that was working a lot on sustainable transport. So that was interesting because I was able to apply some of the things that I was learning about psychology in my hobby and sport and one of the things that I liked about. So that's how I got into the sector. And then I just kept on working on these issues, starting with this NGO here in Bogota. But then I was actually offered a job with the German government and the UN in Bangkok, in Thailand. So I ended up being a coordinator for a project of GIZ in Asia. And then I kept on working in Latin America. I came back to Bogota, and then I started to work much more in Latin America for basically more than 10 years. I then created my own NGO that's called Despacio, which means slow in Spanish. And we worked in supporting Latin American cities on cycling policies, road safety, transit-oriented development, parking management, and policies. And more recently, I started working in the New Urban Mobility Alliance, which is what I do now. I was actually in Washington for the greater part of 2019, but then things changed, and I'm back in Bogota. The pandemic onset made me be here in Bogota for a longer time and basically go back completely. So now I'm working on different things, most of which is Numo oriented and in Bogota, mostly a lot related to COVID work, understanding COVID and transportation, providing recommendations for government on that topic, and linking that to some other issues related to technology in transportation, disruptions in transport. So that is, I hope, a brief summary of my trajectory.
It is, but it's a very comprehensive one. It's amazing how many things you've done, and it all sort of comes back to this time and place and tying into the issues with the pandemic, which I do want to talk about. So you sent me a document, Bicycle Account Bogota 2014. It was a study, and a lot of things were brought up in that study. If you could give us just a little bit of what the study showed then, and what I'm really interested in is what's changed since then. I mean, we're talking 7 years. And then I know that one of the things you've been working on is how technology is changing mobility.
Right. So the idea behind the Bicycle Account was, first of all, to use that beautiful term of Bicycle Account that was the Danish came up with the term to talk about Copenhagen's status of cycling policies, and the attitude of citizens towards cycling as a mode of transport. They do that every 2 years as a government endeavor. It is a wonderful initiative that basically shows you exactly why people use a bicycle, what they would like to see improved, how that relates to government efforts. So we were very happy with that approach in Despacio, and because it is an NGO and we always believed that an NGO should do things for free, let's say, then we just said, well, let's sit down, compile all the information that we can about cycling in Bogota, and let's do some surveys with users to understand how people feel about cycling in Bogota. So, Chris, the document is pretty long in its full version, which is like 80 pages. We did a summary of 4 pages, which is really interesting because it sort of looks at the highlights. But what we found was, first of all, many people talk about Bogota without knowing exactly what has happened here. Nobody had sat down to do a list of sort of the key things, like how many kilometers have been built, how have those kilometers been distributed by mayoral mandate, which was pretty important to many of us, and how the evolution of bicycle use had been since the beginning of the traffic count, which was 1996. So to summarize, because I hope that people look for the study and read it, the Peñalosa first era, first mandate in 1998 to 2000 was the one which had the greatest amount of kilometers built. Nobody else, not even Peñalosa number two in his more recent mandate, has built more than 200 kilometers like he did in the first mandate. But there have been very interesting issues in terms of what has happened in policy and policy development and supporting cycling as a policy and promoting bicycle as a transport mode and understanding cycling. So that is sort of a little bit what we saw in terms of policy.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah, please.
I know the one mayor did the bulk of this work, and you did do a lot of things, study about who was riding and how long and all of that. But do you think that all this bike infrastructure, has it changed Bogota's cycling psyche? I mean, are people looking at cycling differently since all of this infrastructure was put in?
Okay, that's a beautiful question. So what I would say is the bicycle has had a very important place in Colombians' mind since the 50s, and more importantly in the 70s, 80s, for two reasons. One has been the incredible amount of very good professional cyclists worldwide that Colombia has had, who have had great results in cycling competitions, Tour de France, in the Giro and the Vuelta a España. That is one very important thing, which is since the 50s, and more importantly, 70s, 80s. The second thing that has made in Bogota a very, very big impact has been the case of the Ciclovía, which is every Sunday we now have 80 miles of streets, avenues that are now open only for people on bicycles, walking, skateboards, strollers, so no cars, everything else basically that does not have an engine. So those two things are a very important part of cycling for people in Bogota. So the moment when Peñalosa came in 1998, we already knew what a bicycle was. It was the second sport of the country. Like, you have football, soccer, and cycling as the two major sports. And we already had more than a million people going on the ciclovía every Sunday. So it wasn't like Peñalosa came to a blank slate. He came to a place with an incredible potential for cycling as a mode of transport, but where cycling was mostly a mode of transport for people of lower income. And there were few miles of bikeways not oriented towards transportation, but rather as a recreation areas. So what he did was basically that he saw that, and he built 232 kilometers of bikeways, which is roughly 140 or something like that miles, in a span of 3 years. So that started to consolidate the potential of having cycling as a mode of transport. What they didn't do properly, or what they didn't do at all, let's say, was really do everything else. Like, there was no regulatory framework for cycling as a mode of transport. There was no comprehensive promotional strategy. There wasn't even a document officially sanctioned that said how to build a bikeway. And there was no integration with public transport. So there were a lot of things that didn't happen because they focused on infrastructure. So what you could say is Peñalosa was like a very houseman-like infrastructure building maniac for 3 years. And the mayors that came after that, except for one disastrous mayor who is now in jail, every other mayor built upon what he had done in complementing the bikeways, in following through with the proposals, the contracts, everything that had been contracted, and that was part of a plan of building bikeways. But there was also very interesting initiatives in promoting the bicycle, creating sort of an image for cycling as a mode of transport. And then around 2008, when we had sort of these dark ages of cycling policy, where there was no cycling policy, no interest of cycling policy, and our mayor evidently and confirmed by the government, he stole a lot of money and then he didn't build anything. Then advocates sprung, like there was a flourishing of cycling advocacy in the city. And that was sort of a turn of events. Government stopped doing stuff, so then advocates started doing a lot. I was part of the creation of what is now called the Roundtable of the Bicycle for Bogota, where we said, well, look, there's all these things that we have to do. We have to have like a roadmap. So we did the manifest for the bicycle in Bogota. And we started sort of doing these advocacy campaigns. A person was killed on a bicycle. We did the first white bicycle, which is sort of a weird thing to be proud of, because you don't want people dying on bicycles, but you do want to sort of make that visible to everybody. So we did that. We also found that there were four places with bicycle parking, covered bicycle parking, in these beautiful bicycle stations that were just closed and they weren't operating. So we did a funeral for that. We went with our bikes and then took all these, how do you call these, flower arrangements, and then put them on the doors of one of these bicycle stations. And we said, well, if you're not using them, then they're dead. And the next day they opened them for free. Their argument before was that they were too expensive to operate. But then when we did the funeral, then they just opened it up. So you see this flourishing of bicycle advocacy in 2008, 2009, which then was taken up by the next mayor, who said, well, you know what? Cycling seems to be popular. It does seem to be sort of a cycling policy thing that we should promote. And he not only started to do more stuff around cycling policies, but he started to actually hire advocates in government positions. He started to create institutionality, or relaunch some institutionality of cycling. So people in government agencies in charge of cycling policy, cycling infrastructure, cycling initiatives. So that was really interesting. And then you have like Peñalosa too, who said, okay, let's continue what we left before. I could go on about this like crazy. When we published the bicycle account was during the Petro mandate, sort of more or less around the middle of the Petro mandate, where we didn't really see very clearly what was going to happen. where we saw a consolidation of an actual policy of cycling at the local level. We also saw that two or three people were working in government, in the national government also, and they said, well, let's do this government policy on cycling, which hasn't existed since before. So what we saw there was that the national government sort of said, well, look, let's do a cycling design manual. Let's do a financial arrangement so that the national government can provide cycling infrastructure funds from the national level. Let's start doing some initiatives for bicycle taxis, which was really interesting to see from the national level. So that strengthened a lot the things that we had in cycling policy from the national level to the local level. And then you see that the change from one mayor to the next, so from Petro to Peñalosa, continued essentially everything that was happening, except for some cycling sharing schemes that were very small and very manual. But everything else continued. And so that was basically the only policy that continued strongly from one mayor to the next was cycling. And that was pretty interesting because then we saw that this incredible shift in every policy in the city level was completely continued except for one program in this other mandate. And what you see today, like in the Claudia López government, is that it's basically continuing absolutely everything that was there. If I would characterize the Peñalosa number two government, it was sort of a consolidation of efforts, but not much visibility, like not many things done. Sort of preparing for the future, let's say. And then our current mayor began just 2 months before the pandemic completely destroyed everything in terms of every plan that was existing.
This might be a good place to take a break. Do you want to finish off that particular thought and then we'll take a break?
Yeah, so what you see it like in this last mandate is they began in the pandemic onset and they took on the opportunity to increase cycling and to act upon cycling decisively. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's the break.
There's the break. Okay. Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Carlos Pardo. He is in Bogota, Colombia. We've been speaking about what's going on down there, and it seems like a lot. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. A bicycle crash is not an accident, and when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent bike law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back on The Outspoken Cyclist, if you're just joining me, which I hope you're not, because the beginning of this conversation takes us through sort of the history of how cycling has really come to a huge place in Bogota, Colombia. We're speaking with Carlos Pardo, and he is a big part of that. So one of the things that we haven't talked about as we brought all of the things that changed cycling up through the pandemic, two things. One is Of course, everything changed during the pandemic, but we're going to talk about technology, and I'm wondering how technology has impacted cycling in Bogota.
Okay. So I think when we look at technology and disruptions in the transport sector, which is most of what I'm doing in Numo, and sort of the mission of Numo is sort of to understand these disruptions, we see that there's different ways how technology can improve or can change the way that people use their transportation modes. One is a very evident one, that information is much better organized, much easier to find. So you can see easily a map of cycling infrastructure. You can easily see the time that it can take you to get from A to B. And you can basically see everything in maps or data that is readily available from your computer or your phone. So that is one way in terms of information. Another big way, which I think is fundamental for cycling, is the opportunity in new technologies and vehicles related to cycling. That can also be, for example, from your phone, you can track everything that you're doing on the cycle. You can actually see applications that help you ride from one place to the other, see where there are risks or where there are threats in cycling. And the new e-bike surge could be one way that we could see that cycling has changed. Now, specifically how that has impacted Bogota, there were interesting initiatives of implementing many of these applications in the recent past, many of which no longer exist, but they actually did very good inroads in collecting data on cyclists, and they helped a lot in understanding, for example, what was the infrastructure that people used most? And more importantly, how did different changes in infrastructure impact the location and the frequency of use of cycling? So, for example, in 2016, the government did one very big change in a specific corridor. So they took a bikeway that was on the sidewalk and they put it in replacement of a car lane. And that increased cycling levels along that corridor incredibly. But nobody was really tracking it. And then we actually said, well, let's look at this, the before and after, right before they implemented this bikeway. And then we were able to show a map of how exactly people started to use this bikeway and how they increased the use of that bikeway specifically. So that was sort of one specific way. The surge of e-bike use has happened in many different places in the world, not so much in Bogota. And I haven't, or let's say we haven't been able to figure out clearly why e-bikes have not been taken up so dramatically as they have been taken up in other places.
What about price?
Right. So thank you. Price is one of the very clear things that has increased, that has made it more difficult for people to use a good e-bike, right?
Right. Exactly.
So I think a second one is personal safety. So, I mean, I sort of talk a lot to people who have bike shops. I sort of give them advice. And there's one place in particular who actually launched during the pandemic. And they told me, do you think it's a good idea to sort of sell e-bikes? And I said, well, this is exploding and you should get as many as you can. And every 2 or 3 months I asked them again, and they're like, that was the worst idea that you could give us. Like, we haven't been able to sell more than 10 of these.
Wow.
And there's even cases where people have told us, I bought the e-bike yesterday. My partner at home told me, give that back or it's going to be stolen. And they give it back and just say, just give me whatever amount of money you can. I don't care. Like, I purchased it for whatever money. Just give me whatever you can. I'm not going to use it. So safety has become a critical thing. Again, data analysis has been very useful to understand safety in terms of the locations of thefts, the types of thefts, and the record of thefts, and sort of how people register their thefts has been very useful to understand. So that is sort of more of the recent history of Bogota and the sadder side of how cycling has changed in the city. When you look at the data from the Secretary of Security, the only indicator that has been an increase of every theft has been bicycles. So, of course, cycling indicators have gone through the roof. We have almost twice as many people riding a bicycle now when compared to before the pandemic, mostly because people are afraid of using public transport and because many people don't use a car in Bogota because we've never had a very high proportion of people using a car. So people who have been using public transport have taken to bicycles. So absolute amount of people using a bicycle has changed. So then proportionately, theft hasn't changed so much, but in absolute levels, it has changed dramatically because there's more bicycles to steal. There's a hypothesis that there's greater poverty in the cities. So then many people also, it's a shift to becoming burglars. So then they start stealing more. There's a very sad hypothesis from many people, which is that certain people coming from other countries are starting to come here and steal. I don't feel that is fair. I think that is racist. And I think that nobody should say something like that. And I have not seen the data to sort of say,
right, there's no
people
proof
from another country are stealing, right? There may be, but even if there is, I sort of feel that that doesn't help at all in sort of the analysis of.
Let me ask you a question about Copenhagen. And so in terms of theft and in terms of numbers, or Amsterdam or any of the European countries where cycling is such a big part of their transportation system, what is the bike theft situation comparatively there? I mean, are they seeing the same right kinds of numbers?
So the number that I know by heart is that in the Netherlands, there are 16 million bicycles, out of which 1 million are stolen every year. There's a few others which end up in the canals and a few others that are just stolen in quotation marks because it's actually that people have taken them for a spin when they just can't find their bike. Like, there's a dynamic to bicycle theft which needs to be understood clearly. I actually came up with this cycle of bicycle theft that sort of has different stages. And I presented this to the government because they were sort of like haphazardly trying to act. And then I told them, like, look, you have to look at your numbers, which you already have, and base your policy of reducing theft in that. So in the data from Bogota, 30% of thefts are because people leave their bikes unattended in the wrong place with the wrong bicycle lock. This is, again, not such a nice thing to say, but it is true that people here are not used to having good bicycle locks, and they're never used to putting them in appropriate inverted U bicycle parking because it doesn't exist, right? It is very, very scant in terms of the location. So you have a third of thefts, which are, let's say, because of lack of good infrastructure and because users or the owners of the bikes aren't really paying attention to the fact that they need to have a good bicycle lock, period. Like, that's a third. So the solution to that is government, give them better infrastructure. Users, please get better locks. Hopefully, and this is something that I suggested to the government that maybe they'll take it up, give people good bicycle locks, like donate bicycle locks to people. That is sort of administratively complicated, but it can happen. So then you have a third there. There's another third of thefts, which are because people are con artists take their bike. So a few years ago, I sort of documented this because I said, well, how is it that so many people have had their bike stolen in this way and nobody has documented it clearly? So I had a blog in the major newspaper here, and then I just wrote a name. I said, I'm going to call it the millenary tactic. I don't know if that's a word, but it's existed for millennia, right?
Okay.
And the millennial tactic is that somebody goes next to you, and then they come in a bike, you're in a bike, and then they say, oh, hi, I love bicycles, don't you? And then they start riding the bike. And then after a while, then they say, oh, can we stop here because I want to show you these very nice cycling jerseys that I have. This is my uncle's house, and then we're going to look at them, but oh, there's nobody here. How come? I don't know what happened. Just give me a second. Let's look for some. Let's wait until somebody comes. So then you're like in this nice acquaintance, this new acquaintance of a friend, let's say, somebody who you never knew, but he seems to be a sort of somebody who likes bicycles. He's on a bike as well. You just are going to see these jerseys that he brings. And then a third person comes, right, walking towards you. And this is important. He comes with something in his hand, a suitcase, a Coca-Cola bottle, like something, right, which is a little bit heavy. And sort of it's sort of annoying to carry. And then your new acquaintance is, oh, hi, look, this is my cousin. So you know what? Cousin, take my bike. Give me a second. I'll just run like a couple of blocks and then get the key of the house from my uncle. This is a very elaborate thing, right? And then you have the cousin who is sort of there, and then he starts talking to you. And then he says, oh, yeah, so I also like bicycles. And, oh, this bicycle is pretty nice, so let me see it. Oh, it looks beautiful. Can I take a ride on your bike for a second? Like, the first thing they do is, like they tell you, let me carry your bike and see how much it weighs. And then they say, well, can I go for a spin? And you're like, yeah, it's fine. Take it for a spin. And he says, take my suitcase for a second. I'll go for a spin. So you take the suitcase, give them your bike, and they take it for one circle. And after doing one circle near you, they just leave, right? So you have the first person left, the cousin left. You're left with a suitcase, Coca-Cola bottle, something heavy. And after you see them in the distance, you're like, I was just robbed.
Wow, what a scam.
It is a very elaborate con artist scam. So I sort of said, well, we have to document this. And now this is officially used from the government as one of the categories of theft. So this is a third of people. A third of bicycles are stolen that way. So the way that you can start and solve this is give information to people. Like, never talk to somebody who starts talking to you. Friendly, never talk to this person. Never right. Let them take your bike. Like, so you have two-thirds of bikes are stolen that way. And then the remaining third is, well, just a knife or gun point or like horrifying, like really crime theft. I don't know why I was talking so long about this, but that's, I always feel that it's important to differentiate the ways in which bicycles are stolen in Bogota and how you have to act upon this. So
I'm not sure that we wouldn't hear the same scenarios here. I think that they're all plausible, right? And yes. Certainly we know millions and millions of bicycles are stolen every year. Let me take another moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Carlos Pardo. He is in Bogota, Colombia, and studies this stuff in such interesting depth. So before we end this conversation, which actually we could go on all day, you know, we've got this big infrastructure package that Congress is supposedly looking at here in the U.S. And yes. It is getting some attention for biking and walking for the first time in a long time. And we have a new Secretary of Transportation who's very engaged. So if you were asked, what would be, say, the top two or three things to make our cities more livable and with better transportation options, what would you recommend in that infrastructure package to look at first?
So I love Secretary Pete. I love the fact that even
don't we all
even if the Secret Service makes a fuss about him going on a bike, he does his best to go on a bike to meetings.
Right.
So he gets it. So there are very simple ways, even outside of the scope of the infrastructure package, like commit to spending 10% of the budget that you have for infrastructure today for cycling and walking. Only by doing that, you will see thousands and thousands of new miles of well-designed bicycle infrastructure, which is well-designed, a good segregation, like that kind of thing. I think that is fundamental. And if the infrastructure package includes something to that effect, for example, let's spend 10% in improvements to the infrastructure for people walking and cycling, which will be the bikeways, the intersections, the stoplights for cycling and walking, and world-class cycling parking, you will get a lot of things done. So I think that is one big component. The second thing that I feel would be incredibly useful is to continue doing what some states have started to contemplate, which is when you do cash for clunker schemes, so when people give a car and then they get in return some form of benefit to purchase an electric vehicle, include e-bikes in the definition of electric vehicle. So if somebody is excited about electric mobility, they should be more excited when they know that electric bikes are an actual option that they should use.
What a cool idea, Carlos.
It isn't really my idea. Like, we've been talking about this within NUMO for a long time. It is a little bit of a moonshot, I think, but it's like so easy conceptually, at least.
Yeah.
If a vehicle is defined as something in which you sit and it helps you get from A to B, electric vehicle subsidies should apply to e-bikes. The one thing that we are extremely excited about in NUMO is let's have e-bikes in everything that we do. If people aren't willing to use a bicycle, they will be willing to use an e-bike. And that is grounded in research, that is grounded in people's experience. They not only like or have a greater probability of using an e-bike, they love using an e-bike every time. Like, we've been sort of talking to people, and I actually wrote a blog post about this in the NUMO blog. Please go look at it. It's about joyful instant transportation. The only modes of transport where people are joyful are, I have to say, motorbikes to an extent, but bicycles and to an incredible extent, e-scooters and electric bikes. And electric bikes are the most versatile vehicles that are out there. It is incredible, everything that you can do with an e-bike. I mean, I sound like a salesman, but the e-bike is the solution to mobility that we need to focus on today. Hmm. If you read Lynch and when he was writing like one very long book, The City, Good City Forum, in one of his annexes, he says, the perfect vehicle is, and if you read his description of the perfect vehicle, the closest that you have today is an e-bike. If an e-bike would be weather protected, you would have the perfect vehicle that David Lynch, the Good City Forum. That's what he defined decades ago. And when you look at the data today of e-bike uptake, the mode shift of people when they start using e-bikes, the greater reduction in CO2 emissions when you include e-bikes in the subsidy schemes, then you really get somewhere. Like, stop thinking about e-mobility without including e-bikes. And so you asked me about two things. So proportion of the budget for actual good infrastructure for cycling and micro-mobility in general, and including e-bikes in the subsidies of electric mobility, we will have an incredible change and an incredible mode shift in transportation in many cities in the U.S., regardless of the incredible low density, because the e-bike will help them get to very long distances, which were not previously possible in a regular bicycle. So I hope that's useful as sort of my take, complemented by NUMO's joyful proposal to improve e-mobility and improve cycling.
So what I'd like to do at this point, because unfortunately we have to wrap up this episode, is first of all, invite you back to talk again, because I think the conversation could be different and pertinent. And the second is for you to give my listeners right now how they can get to some of the documents we've talked about. I mean, I will post them on our blog. I will post them on our Facebook page. But how they can connect with NUMO ongoingly.
Okay. So please follow NUMO in Twitter. It's @NUMOAlliance. And then you can find all the details there. NUMO also has a blog where we've published very few blog post when comparatively with other blogs, but I feel they're very nice because we talk about magic carpets, we talk about joyfulness, and it's a Medium blog. And then feel free to follow me also at Carlos F. Pardo in Twitter, and then I'll be happy to sort of share some of the things that we've been doing. And I think that is sort of the best way of getting around to things. I think that the Bogota stuff that I was mentioning at the beginning, is it's easier to go to the website of Despacio, which unfortunately continues to be in Spanish, regardless of my insistence to them to do things in English. But if you Google bicycle account Bogota, I'm almost sure you'll find it very quickly, the link to the document that I was mentioning.
And I have a copy. So I will make sure that I make that link available.
Perfect. And that's great that if you do it in the show notes, if you have show notes, then
we
that
do.
Would be great to get people connected.
Well, Carlos, thank you so much. Dr. Combs was absolutely correct in it telling me it would be a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me today. Once again, we've been talking with Carlos Pardo. He is a psychologist, but so much more. We talked about sustainability and bicycle. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you, Darren. This was great.
Thanks
for everyone for listening.
Carlos Pardo joined me from his home in Bogota, Colombia. To learn more about his work and the work of Numo, you can log on to www.numo.global. And if you would like to read the Bicycle Account 2014, there is a link to the document in English at outspokencyclist.com for today's episode. My thanks to Billy Binion from Reason.com and to Carlos Pardo for a great show this week. And my thanks to you for listening. Remember to check out our Facebook page for current discussions or go to our blog, outspokencyclist.com, if you'd like to leave a comment. Next week, we'll be speaking with the Miami Dolphins' Javier Sanchez about the organization's annual philanthropic ride, and with Scottish chef Alan Murchison about his new book, The Cycling Chef. Until then, I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps, and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.